Hello again, this is Pastor Jeff Riddle from Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And this week I did a post to my blog offering a critique of an article that was on another blog, the Reformation 21 blog, and I thought it might be helpful to also do an audio on this topic. So you can see the original article that I wrote at jeffriddle.net, and this is going to be more of a spoken word version of that. So a friend emailed me this week and sent me a link to this article that was written by Ryan M. Reeves and was posted sometime this month. It simply says February 2016, doesn't give the day, on the Reformation 21 blog. And the article is titled Church History's Greatest Myths. I'm not sure if that's a series where Reeves is doing a series of articles on this topic, on other myths. But then the sort of subtitle is Erasmus and the Greek New Testament. I had not heard of Reeves before. I did a little cursory search on the internet for him. And also within the article itself, at the very end, there's a blurb that notes that he is an assistant professor of historical theology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, and he also serves as the dean of the Jacksonville, Florida campus of Gordon-Conwell Seminary. I didn't know Gordon-Conwell had a Jacksonville, Florida, branch of their seminary. But anyways, I looked around a little bit more for Reeves. He got a PhD at Cambridge University, and he's got a YouTube channel on various topics in historical theology. Actually, along the way, I just listened to excerpts of a couple of the videos. They're very well put together visually. It's funny, though, I noticed two things. One is I looked at a little bit of a video that he had on Greco-Roman backgrounds for the New Testament, I think. And I noticed in the comments there were several people were commenting on some, what they thought were some historical inaccuracies in some of the things that he said. It kind of reminded me of some of the things I call attention to in the article. And then also noticed that he had a couple of posts, one on The Hobbit and a couple parts on Tolkien's The Silmarillion. And so anyway, just thought it was interesting that he apparently has an interest in sort of inklings, Catholic, Anglican writings on fables and so forth. But anyways, fantasy, I guess that's the word. So when I saw the heading for his article, though, which was, again, Church History's Greatest Myths, Erasmus and the Greek New Testament, I was intrigued by that for a couple of reasons. The topic sounded interesting to me in particular because I have had some of my own interests in area of study has been Erasmus and his Greek New Testament, which served as the foundation for the Textus Receptus, and this year, 2016, is the 500th anniversary of the publication of the Novum Instrumentum, which was the printing of the Greek and Latin New Testament that became so influential, the first edition of it, and then there were multiple editions after that. And then I'm actually going here in a couple of weeks to a conference in Houston, Texas at Houston Baptist University. That's going to be one of the few conferences, the only one that I've heard of in the United States, that is marking the anniversary of Erasmus's Greek New Testament. Reeves points out in the article that next year, 2017, will be the 500th anniversary of Luther's posting the 95 Theses, which started the Protestant Reformation. And I'm sure there will be a lot of commemorations of the Reformation next year. But anyways, I was intrigued by the topic, and also the mention of the word myth, because I've noted before on previous Word magazines, on blog posts, that it seems to me that there are a lot of myths that circulate around Erasmus and around his publishing of the Textus Receptus. And I think a big part of that is that there was a concerted effort, particularly in the 19th century, to downplay the significance of Erasmus's achievement in getting the first printed New Testament. Part of that was antagonism against the Textus Receptus and against the King James Version in English-speaking circles, and the attempt to replace it with the Greek Bible, with the modern critical edition, and then to have modern translations like the Revised Version of 1881 to challenge the reigning sort of position that the TR and correspondingly the King James Version in English-speaking circles had. So anyways, I was intrigued by the article. What are some of the myths that I alluded to related to Erasmus that I've seen in scholarly works? One myth is that the Erasmus's first edition was an error-filled rush job, that he was somehow attempting to beat the Spanish Complutensian polyglot to the market, to be the first one on the market with the Greek New Testament. That another big myth that actually Reeves does not, thankfully, does not address in his article is that he left out, Erasmus left out the Coma Johanneum, 1 John 5, 7, and 8, in the first two editions of his Greek New Testament. And he was criticized for that, and there's a scholarly story that goes that he made a rash vow, a rash promise, that he would include it if a single Greek manuscript could be produced which had it. And so the story goes, a manuscript was custom made or fabricated for that very purpose, and so his critics forced him to include the Coma Johanneum in its third edition. And that story has been debunked, was debunked in a 1980 article by the Dutch scholar De Jong, and but it still gets circulated. And also, it's often said Erasmus, he's criticized for not having an adequate number of Greek manuscripts, and he's also often, there's an anecdote mentioned about him back-translating passages, most notably the ending of Revelation, but there's too often there's very little direct information about this. It seems to be a bit shadowy, as I understand it. So I thought, well, maybe Reeves is going to address some of these myths about Erasmus. So I was intrigued. Unfortunately, when I read the article, I was disappointed. He begins promisingly by noting that there has been a lot of mythology surrounding Erasmus's Greek New Testament. Unfortunately, though, he then proceeds to, I think, further a lot of scholarly myths by noting things like, and this is a quote, Erasmus's slapdash effort to bring the text to print, end quote. And he speaks of Erasmus stepping, quote, into a quagmire of textual criticism. And it's a bit of a, the writing is a bit, has a lot of flourish in it. He adds, the tale of Erasmus is embellished to the point of being an overfed caricature of Reformation hagiography. He proceeds to note how Erasmus, quote, cobbled together a series of Greek texts, end quote. And he talks about Erasmus using his flawless humanistic skills. I found his reference to Erasmus being flawless as interesting, particularly since later on he'll accuse him of making many errors, but he talks about his flawless humanistic skill. And this, quote, fueled the rise of textual, linguistic, and scholarly work on the Bible, end quote. Well, already having, I think, inadvertently promoted a number of Erasmian myths, we finally get to what Reeves says is the real Erasmian myth. And the real Erasmian myth, from which he gets the title of this blog post, is that there has been a misunderstanding of the historical context in which Erasmus's Greek New Testament appeared. The first misstep, he says, is, quote, the idea that Greek had been completely lost until the 16th century, end quote. According to Reeves, there was robust interest in the biblical languages prior to the Reformation, and Roman Catholics only staked out dogmatic commitments to the Latin Vulgate after the Reformation, or as a result of the Reformation. And I found this line of argumentation particularly interesting and a bit disconcerting. For one thing, I know this is a popular blog post. It's not an academic article. It's certainly not an academic monograph. But at this point, and a number of points along the way, I began to ask myself, where's the proof for this? I wanted to see citations. I wanted to see footnotes. I wanted to see who else has argued that there was widespread interest in the Bible and the original languages prior to the Protestant Reformation. Maybe he has some evidence for this. I'm just not aware of it. It seems to me that that the emphasis of the Reformation was on the recovery of the original languages. One of the slogans of the Protestant Reformation was Ad Fontes, back to the sources. Certainly, this was a significant commitment of the Reformers, and it did stand in stark contrast to the Roman Catholics, who had given authority to the Latin Vulgate. When you look also at the providential circumstances, after the fall of Constantinople, there were Greek manuscripts, both pagan and Christian works, that flooded into Western Europe. There were also Greek-speaking scholars who fled the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire into Western Europe. And so this created sort of the perfect providential storm, we might call it, that would create the rise of Renaissance humanism, the interest in the classical world, and then among Protestants, those who would become Protestants, like Luther and others, the desire to go back and read the Bible in the original languages. Much as Jerome had done when he made the Latin translation, he translated it from the original Hebrew rather than the Greek Septuagint, the Old Testament, that is. And then I was thinking about Wycliffe. You know, Wycliffe was the first person one of the first people to translate the Bible into English, but he didn't do it from Greek. He did it from Latin. He translated it from Latin to English. So, and I agree that after the Protestant Reformation was in full bloom, yes, there were. This did lead to dogmatic statements, whether that was the Council of Trent on the Roman Catholic side declaring authoritatively, dogmatically, that the Latin Vulgate was the standard of authority as interpreted by the Roman Catholic Magisterium. And on the Protestant side, you know, we get confessions of faith like the Westminster Confession of Faith and daughter confessions like the Second London Baptist Confession that in Chapter 1 on Scripture stress that Scripture is immediately inspired in the original languages. I mean, that's a differentiation from the Roman Catholic position. There's a place for translations. Translations are useful, but the Bible is immediately inspired in the original Hebrew and the original Greek. So for some reason, Reeves, it appears to me, wants to downplay this and to say, oh, there really wasn't much difference. People were interested in the Bible in the original languages prior to Erasmus. It's a myth to think that they had no interest. I'm not saying that there wasn't any interest at all, but it seems hard to ignore the fact that there was a set of providential circumstances in the 16th century that were unique that led to the Protestant Reformation, and that's different than circumstances that were previous or prior. Reeves then proceeds to assert that Erasmus was not a true, quote, Greek scholar by today's standards, end quote. He points out that today we have Greek grammars, modern grammars that run to 1,400 pages in length. He claims that Erasmus only spent 5 years learning Greek while in Cambridge. And there are a couple things, several things that to me don't seem quite right with this assessment. First, I pulled off my shelf Roland Bainton, Bainton's celebrated biography of Erasmus called Erasmus of Christendom. And I looked in there and I found on page 59 his discussion of Erasmus's years at in England when he sharpened his interest in the Greek language, and in particular in the Greek New Testament. And therein, Roland Bainton says that Erasmus, quote, learned the rudiments, end quote, of Greek before he had ever come to England. And he points out that in his 1500 work, The Adages, he had several extended Greek quotations. And then he notes that by the time he left England for Paris, and again, he had 5 years. That might not seem like a long time, but for someone like Erasmus, who was particularly gifted and already knew, was well-grounded in Latin, a classical language that certainly has much relationship to Greek and dependence upon Greek, by the time he left for Paris, Erasmus, Bainton says, wrote and said he would rather spend his money buying Greek books than he would spend his money buying clothes. You often hear people say, I'd rather get a good book than eat. He said he'd rather get a good Greek book than be clothed. Most importantly, I think, Erasmus was a peerless classical scholar and a brilliant linguist. Men of his generation had a facility with ancient languages that really cannot be duplicated in the modern scene. And so I think it would be wrong to say that Erasmus was held back because he lacked having a modern 1,400-page grammar. I think he did just fine with his knowledge of Greek. In fact, I was recently reading an article by T.H.L. Parker on Calvin, and he was talking about how Calvin, in his commentaries, made many references to Erasmus and how Calvin admired Erasmus's ability with Greek, even though Parker says that Calvin's knowledge of the biblical languages surpassed that of Erasmus. But Calvin was admiring of Erasmus's abilities with Greek, even if he did not always agree with him. Reeves also strangely suggests that Erasmus had a naive view of the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, thinking, as Reeves puts it, that he need only to walk into a library, find several editions, and then head off to the publisher. He says editions of the Greek text, really that should be manuscripts of the text. I assume what he's saying is that Erasmus naively thought he just needed to go into a few libraries in Basel and other places and get a few Greek manuscripts, and then he would be able to transcribe those and print them. I think that's too negative and too naive a view of Erasmus. Indeed, Erasmus has often been faulted, particularly, like I said, in scholars in the 19th century, I think, who want to downplay his achievement in favor of the modern critical text. He's often been criticized because he used relatively few Greek manuscripts to compile his Greek New Testament. But given the fact that his text, the text of the Textus Receptus, was largely based on the majority or the Byzantine text scores of manuscripts were hardly necessary. If one had a single Byzantine manuscript, that would basically be the same as hundreds of others. And he actually had access to a Greek manuscript that's called Manuscript 1. And this is the namesake for a family of manuscripts that are called Family 1. And so he had this manuscript in particular, which was apparently very closely related to many others. So I don't think this criticism is justified. Also, Erasmus, I think, exercised due diligence in seeking out Greek manuscripts. He wrote to others, including apparently writing to a friend in Rome and asking him to compare readings that were found in Codex Vaticanus in Rome. Reeves repeats also the popular anecdote that I've already mentioned about Erasmus back translating the final verses of Revelation. But again, this assertion is not easily verifiable. It seems to be traced back to some references in the 19th century and to a German article. And the direct references to Erasmus, to his annotations, are less forthcoming. I'm not saying that Erasmus didn't possibly do some back translation. I'm just saying that the story is often circulated without any proof, and I haven't yet seen direct proof of this. I would love to be able to examine that if that were put forward. Again, I know this isn't an academic article. It's a popular blog post, but I'd like to see some references. He throws out other anecdotes, including saying that Erasmus at one point added a phrase at Acts 9:6, and he forgot, quote, which verses in Revelation were his. But again, no hard or specific evidence is provided. We're only left with questions. So for the Acts 9:6 passage, for example, if he's saying Erasmus at some point considered options that he thought might have been legitimate for Acts 9:6, but if in the end he didn't adopt them, how can you possibly fault him? And then which verses in Revelation exactly is Reeves talking about? He doesn't cite them. It's just sort of anecdotal, unfounded types of accusations against Erasmus's skill and ability. Reeves furthermore repeats the what I could call the rush to print and I would call it the error-laden myths of Erasmus's Greek New Testament. He even has the audacity to blame Erasmus for creating, as he puts it, quote, one of the great publishing catastrophes in early modern history. Errors in typesetting and transcription appeared everywhere. Ouch! I mean, that is quite a charge against Erasmus. And it is one that is commonly promoted in seminary classrooms and in seminary textbooks. But I have run across some who hold a different opinion. One of the persons I've read who holds a different opinion is the Erasmian scholar at Oxford University, M.A. Screech. He wrote an introduction to Erasmus's annotations of the New Testament, the Gospels, that's edited by Anne Reeve. And in that introduction, he offers a different assessment of Erasmus's work. He says the idea that Erasmus hurriedly skimped in his editing of the Greek New Testament, particularly as it's often popularly put forward to beat the Spaniards into print, he calls this, quote, a legend repeated from book to book for a century or more, end quote. He also says concerning Erasmus's annotations or his notes on the New Testament, he says they were remarkably free from misprints, and he adds, quote, Even the Greek New Testament is not quite so full of them, that is, errors, as is often alleged, end quote. Yes, Erasmus' work was not well received by some in his day, as Reeves points out, most especially, I think, by those who were committed to the Roman Catholic Church and Roman Catholic doctrine. They did not like his challenge to the Vulgate. As Reeves rightly points out, and other scholars like, again, de Jong, have more solidly argued and explained, Erasmus' primary concern in the Novum Instrumentum, although we, in hindsight, think the most important thing was the first printing of the Greek New Testament, Erasmus' view was that the most important thing about the Novum Instrumentum wasn't his Greek text, it was his Latin translation, it was his new translation that he with which he wanted to correct and improve the Latin Vulgate. That's what he thought was his primary work. The Greek New Testament was really just a supplement for him to the Latin work. Now, early reformers were more interested in the Greek text, and that's what they were able to pick up and read. So Luther was able to use this and produce the first German translation of the New Testament from the original language Greek into German. Tyndale was able to take this and translate the first English translation of the New Testament. Calvin was able to use Erasmus in the production of his Latin translations that he used in his commentaries. So these used Erasmus. But really the key thing about Erasmus is the fact that later Protestant scholars like Stephanus and Theodore Beza, Calvin's successor at Geneva, they took Erasmus and they did some editing and some improvements on it. And they were able to publish the Greek text that came to be called the Textus Receptus, that was so influential in the Protestant movement, the text that was studied and exegeted by preachers and by scholars, the text that was the basis for the Protestant vernacular translations of the Bible. And this is the real significance of Erasmus's Greek New Testament. The second misstep, which Reeves identifies, is the supposed assumption that the early reformers could learn biblical languages, quote, without limits, end quote. This is another place where I'd like to see citations. What authors of the past or contemporary authors have argued that they believe that the reformers could learn the biblical languages without any limits? He notes especially the weaknesses of the early reformers with the Hebrew language. And I thought of two objections to that. First, Reeves, again, provides no specific examples. Show me a text in the Old Testament that was misunderstood because of inadequate grammar or inadequate linguistic information. What did they misunderstand? Give me an example. And then secondly, he talks about the Protestant reformers and their weaknesses in Hebrew, but he fails to note that really the transmission of the Hebrew Bible wasn't dependent upon the reformers, but it was dependent upon the Jewish Masoretic scribes who had kept alive and had transmitted what we might call the Textus Receptus of the Old Testament, that is the Masoretic text of the Hebrew Bible. One of the main rubs I have with Reeves throughout this article is that he seems to assert that we, as moderners, know the Bible and the biblical languages better than the reformers did. We have what he calls a comedy of riches. I just thought that was a strange metaphor. We have a comedy of riches at our digital fingertips. But this doesn't mean that we have a mastery of the ancient languages or the discipline that the great men of the Reformation had. As he talks about, they didn't have the knowledge of ancient Near Eastern cognate languages. They didn't have the archaeological finds that we have. He doesn't mention the unsealed manuscripts, but maybe he's thinking they didn't have the unsealed manuscripts or the papyri or things like that. And I would simply ask, would Martin Luther's access to the Dead Sea Scrolls, or would his access to knowing the Akkadian language, would this really have made him a better expositor of the doctrine of justification by faith, the doctrine upon which the faith stands or falls? Does a modern seminary graduate really finish his degree with, as Reeves puts it, a stronger foundation in biblical grammar than men of Erasmus's day or Erasmus himself had? I just don't find that very convincing. This is a, I thought of something, and I didn't get a chance to put this in the article, so this is a bonus. I thought of a passage in Adam Nicholson's book on the making of the King James Bible, called God's Secretaries, the making of the King James Bible. And I remembered a passage in here where he was talking about one of the editors of the and translators of the King James Bible named Lancelot Andrews. And he talks about how men of that generation were just so much better educated. They were better educated in language learning. They were better educated in classical learning. They were better educated in just the discipline of their time. And of Lancelot Andrews, this is page 33, he says, "The man was a library, the repository of 16 centuries of Christian culture. He could speak 15 modern languages and 6 ancient, but the heart and bulk of his existence was his sense of himself as a worm." Later on, he says of Andrews on the same page, "People like Lancelot Andrews no longer exist, but the presence in one man of what seems to be such divergent qualities is precisely the key to the age. It is because people like Lancelot Andrews flourished in the first decades of the 17th century and do not now that the greatest translation of the Bible could be made then and cannot now." And if I were to take that passage and paraphrase it, apply it to Erasmus, I might say, people like Erasmus no longer exist. They flourished in the first decades of the 16th century and do not now. And it was because they did that great editions of the Bible in the original languages could be made then and perhaps cannot be made now. Yes, 2016 marks the 500th anniversary of Erasmus's Greek New Testament being published in 1516. It is a work that is still surrounded by myths, and I'm afraid that Ryan Reeves' article has only added, I think, to some of the myths that surround Erasmus rather than alleviating them. So that's my spoken word review or critique of Ryan Reeves's post. I hope you found this helpful, and look forward to hearing feedback from some of you. Take care, and God bless. For his presence, for the ever-living God, when shall I behold his face in his holy dwelling place? Now I feed on tears from weeping, while they say, "Is your God sleeping?" All these things I call to memory, and I ponder in my heart, how with throngs I moved rejoicing to his temple's sacred court. Why my soul be in despair, why this worry and this care? Hope in God, my soul's salvation, him I'll praise with jubilation. When my heart despairs within me, then will I recall once more, as the headwaters of Jordan from the Mount of Hermon pour. Deep to deep roars out its sound, waves in rapids surging round. In the day God's love comes freely, and at night his song is with me. To my God, my rock, I murmur,
how could you forget me? How? All my foes oppress and taunt me. Where's your God? They ask me now. Why my soul be in despair? Why this worry and this care? Hope in God, my soul's salvation. Him I'll praise with jubilation.